This is Chuck Sikinga interviewing Mr. John Paff for the Tri-Cities Museum, take two, on September 17th, 1991.
What we got? Take that out. All right. We've got 45 minutes.
Yeah.
That's quite a while. Okay, let's see. Are you going to start all over, or you want to just pick it up there?
Start from right here again.
Okay. So. I guess I said my name, didn't I? My name is John Paff. Are we ready?
Yep. You were born in
19... I was born on August 22nd, 1913, in Grand Haven, Michigan,
right,
at 532 Pennoyer Avenue. In 1860, my grandfather, Charles J. Paff, moved his family, which consisted of his wife, Gertrude, three sons, John, Fred, and Charlie, and one daughter, Gertrude, from Saugatuck, Michigan to Grand Haven. And he accepted the job as the first marshal of the city of Grand Haven. He built a home on Water Street, which is now Harbor Avenue. It was in the first 100 block of Water Street. And he also owned property in the 200 block on Water Street. Of course, at that time, all the activity of Grand Haven was centered on the harbor with the boat and the fishing industries. My grandfather had an insurance agency in Grand Haven. He also had a branch office in Grand Rapids. And I can recall riding on the Inurban streetcar with him to Grand Rapids on occasions. We'd board the Inurban in Grand Haven, and then we'd have to change cars at the junction, which was close to Nunica. And we'd transfer to a Muskegon car and take that car on into Grand Rapids. In the wintertime, the conductor would have to heat the cars with a pot-belly stove, which he'd feed coal to every once in a while to keep us warm. My grandfather always cautioned me about watching out for the third rail. Of course, there were two rails that the car ran on, and the third rail provided the electricity to operate the car. And, of course, you had to be careful. If you stepped on it, you could be severely burned or possibly killed. We'd also, on occasions, take the Inurban to Fruitport during our annual Presbyterian picnic. We'd all get on the Inurban and ride it to Fruitport and back. Also, during the summertime, we'd ride the dummy park car out to the Highland Park Pavilion. And out there, we'd rent a bathhouse and maybe a bathing suit, and we'd go swimming for the afternoon. And the fare, as I remembered it, was 5 cents out there and 5 cents back, and the bathhouse would cost you 5 cents to rent.
And how long was the trip to Grand Rapids?
The trip to Grand Rapids would be approximately 1 hour. Also, this park car would travel out to what they call the Inden Village and make its turnaround out there and then back to town. In the spring of the year, they always had to get a crew of about 25, 50 men to shovel the sand off of the tracks, because all winter long that sand would blow and it would cover the tracks. So it was quite a job to get those tracks cleared every spring.
But did the dummy line, did that use the third rail too, or did they have the wire?
They had a wire, overhead wire, which would be a little safer for in town. And even the Inurbans, as they came into a town, they'd switch from the third rail to the overhead wire to go through towns. The summertime, there was always about 10 of us fellas. we'd get together and we'd camp for 1 or 2 weeks on the North Shore. The Coast Guard were always very helpful. If we signaled them, they would row the boat across, pick us up, and take us over, so we didn't have to walk way around through Ferrisburg to get to our campsite. We camp about a mile up the shore. At that time, there were no houses over there outside of the Soul Cottage, which was located right back of the Coast Guard station. So we pretty much had the whole North Shore to ourselves for the summertime. Also during the summer, we would attend the Chautauqua performances. And they'd set up a tent on the site of the present hospital and put on these plays. Also, they would have dog and pony shows on that site, as well as out the east end of town where they had some large fields out there. Also, for several years during the summer, they had a riding stable across from the entrance to the cemetery. And we'd rent these horses for, as I remember it, $1 an hour. And we'd ride through Duncan's Woods and also on Green Hill, which is the site of the present high school. We'd also ride out Sheldon Road. And, of course, at that time, there was no paving. It was all strictly a dirt road. And it was a beautiful spot through there. They had a lot of maple trees. And we really used to enjoy it a great deal. During the summer, kids would always follow the ice wagons for swipe a few pieces of ice to suck on. They had the Spring Lake Ice Company and also the National Ice Company that peddled ice in Grand Haven. I think that was a natural ice company, not national. I can remember my mother would post an ice card in the window, and it was a square card, and one side it would mark 25 pounds, the other side 50 pounds, 75 pounds, 100 pounds. And whatever size cake of ice you wanted, you'd put that card so that that amount would show at the top of the card. And the iceman would deliver it up to your icebox. And during the winter months, the men would cut ice from Spring Lake and store it in large warehouses with sawdust thrown around between it, the blocks, and so forth. Also during the summer, they had Thompson's Jackie Band. It was made up of local fellows, and they would play concerts in Central Park. They had a bandstand there, and we kids used to play on the two large iron cannons they had in the park. I imagine they were either from the Spanish-American War or Civil War cannons. And during World War II, they had scrap drives, and the city donated the cannons to those scrap drives. Also, we had a fellow in town. We called him Blind Ed. He was a Negro, and he had a Victrola on a cart, and he would park it alongside of Hostetter's news agency, and he'd play music. And he'd have a tin cup with some pencils that if you put in a nickel or a dime, you could help yourself to a pencil. Also, the Salvation Army on Saturday and Sunday nights would have a little band concert along with a religious meeting there on Hostetter's Corner. Then on occasions during the summer, we'd have what we called a snake oil hustler come to town, and he would sell this bottled patent medicine that would cure all ills. I remembered he'd charge $1 per bottle, or 2 bottles for $1.50, 3 bottles for $2. He'd also have a large kerosene lamp on this cart, which attracted the attention. Maybe somebody played a trumpet or a horn or beat a bass drum. And they seemed to be quite a popular thing during this day. I belonged to the Boy Scout troop number one, was a Presbyterian church troop. Dick Van Hoven was the scoutmaster. And in the summer, we'd have our camping out at Camp McCarthy. Later on, they named that Camp Kirk. Spent a lot of time watching horses being shoed at the DeGlopper's blacksmith shop. And that was located in the second block of Second Street in back of Hostetter's. That'd be north of Hostetter's. Right in back of Hostetter's, they had Zalzma's Difficult Repair Shop. It was primarily a bicycle sales and repair shop. He was also a handyman to repair anything else that you might needed to have fixed. Next to the Difficult Repair Shop was Schaffsma's Harness Shop. And he'd make horse harnesses and a lot of other leather goods.
This is all headed north on 2nd
Street? North on 2nd and back of Hostetter's. Then the kids, in those days, we used to make our scooters. And I can remember we'd take an old pair of roller skates and get a chunk of 2x4, maybe 3-4 feet in length. We'd fasten those skates, one on the front, one on the back. Then we'd get an orange crate, nail it on the top, and put another little piece of wood across the top for handles, and that would be our scooter. And some would fix them up kind of elaborate. We'd get an old tin can, cut the front out, put a candle in it, then we could ride them at night. And it was kind of a popular toy, you might say, in those days. Then we also did a lot of roller skating. And I can remember, especially in the spring of the year, we used to have big parties in Central Park, roller skate parties. Seems so half the town would be there to have a lot of fun. Also, one summer, it was 1932, it was right after I graduated from high school, we just purchased a 1927 Buick sedan. It was a 7-passenger sedan. And we were kind of riding around town trying it out. And the alarm went out that there was a robbery at the People's Bank. So we tear over there, and sure enough, the bank had been robbed. There was a little gunfire, and I think there's still some bullet holes in the building across the street that used to be the Masonic Temple's, now Oaks' Insurance Company. Mm-hmm. That you can still see the bullet holes on the side door. I think it was Ted Bolt that had a gun and shot at the robbers. And they confiscated a car and from Mrs. Bonema. And she had her baby in the back seat of the car. His name was Norm. And the robbers started to make their getaway in this car, and they had, of course, had several bags of money, which they were throwing the money out in the street so the kids would run out there and get it and keep the cars from chasing them, the police from chasing them. But anyway, they finally abandoned the car, and neither Norm or his mother were hurt. But we had heard that the car was out on Sheldon Road, out quite a way, so we drove out that way. There was an abandoned car out there in one field. I don't know whether it belonged to the robbers or not, but it was quite a lot of excitement at that time.
Yeah, I guess.
We had a Mr. Clarence Buell. That's spelled B-U-H-L. And he had a drain business. And he had about six or eight horses. And his barn was located on Sheldon Road, about a block south of Grant Street, right on the corner there. I can't think of what the name of that street is there, but anyway, it's a block south of Grant. And he lived across the street, and he had this big barn and on the other side of the road, and with the horses in it. And he also dug basements for new homes. In those days, they dug basements with a horse and a big scoop on the back of the horse, or that the horse pulled. He also had a horse-drawn funeral hearse, along with what they called hacks for the people to ride in those days. And I can remember when one of my grandfathers passed away, this funeral, I was pretty young at the time, but anyway, they had Mr. Buell and had his hearse, and we rode in this hack out the cemetery. His son, Roy, was about my age, and I was fairly friendly with him. And he owned a Shetland pony and buggy, and it was a great deal when he used to take me for a ride out Sheldon Road in this buggy. We used to have a lot of fun. I also remember the cement and pulp boats used to come into Robbins Dock during the summer months, and they would unload them and store the pulp in what used to be the AMP Muffler Company building on right on the highway.
Yeah.
You'd store the bales of pulp, and I worked on them several years. And the cement boats, it was a real undesirable job. You had to go down in the hole of the boat, and you had a partner, and you'd each help each other lift a bag of cement. Sometimes it'd be so dusty down there you couldn't even see your partner. But we'd unload these boats, and they'd ship this cement all over the state of Michigan. During the winter months, we used to do a lot of ice skating, what they call the boom. That's where it's on the island where the municipal power plant is located now.
Okay.
And we'd get a gang and clean off the snow there. And Eddie Akins was the caretaker. He was hired by the city to kind of oversee the whole operation. And he'd have a big bonfire there to help keep us warm. And we used to have a lot of fun there ice skating. Then we'd have horse-drawn sleigh rides. I think it was Klaus Dykhouse who had a big sleigh. And maybe 15, 20 of us would rent it, and we'd have these sleigh rides. Then go over to somebody's house afterwards and have cocoa and cake or cookies. Then I can recall that there was a real bad fire on Five Mile Hill. Now that is where the city water tanks are located. It would be across the road from the cemetery, be north, that whole ridge up there. And that we always called Five Mile Hill. And they had a real bad fire there, and they announced it at school, and some of us older fellows were allowed to get out of school and go and help fight the fire. And it was quite an experience.
How did you help fight the fire?
Well, we had bags, burlap bags, stamp it out that way, and they'd put water, soak them, wet the bags, and we just pound the fire best we could. But it pretty well burned it over. Then also I can remember that Akeley College, well, that's located, that was located where the City Hall is now, in that area. And it was an all-girls school, Episcopal school. And the girls, around 4 o'clock every afternoon, 5 o'clock, would take a walk as a group. We all wore the white middies and kind of bloomer pants, and they'd walk around the streets of Grand Haven just for the exercise. But it was always quite a sight.
Keep crowds of young guys following them around, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure, all ogling them. Another strange thing that I recall, that it wasn't unusual for hobos to come to your back door and ask for a handout, food of some kind. Now, we lived at 532 Pennoyer, which wasn't too far from the railroad tracks. And I imagine they got off the train somewhere down there. They'd come up there and they'd ask if they could have a sandwich or a roll or a piece of bread or something. Then during the spring, I can remember in the post office downtown, they'd have shipment of chickens, chicks, little chicks. And it would be, you walk in the post office, you hear all these chicks peeping. It was quite a sound. One time I had an ulcerated tooth, and Dr. Hoffma, who was a local general practitioner, had to lance it. And the next day he came and he gave me a little flower pot with a spruce tree in it. And I planted that in the front yard. And it grew and it grew and grew, so it got tall in the house. And I think about 10 years ago they finally had to cut it down. It was so large. But Dr. Hoffma, he was quite a naturalist. He raised Christmas trees. He had farms out there. And I thought it was quite nice of him to do that for me. Then we had what they call the Boom Guards Pump. Now that was located on the corner of 4th and Fulton Street, right where the Masonic Temple is now, across the street, right on that corner. And it was so excellent cold water. It was well water pump. And I guess what impressed me most, they had a community tin drinking cup. Everybody used the same cup. It was hanging on the pump. Uh-huh. And you walk by there, well, you could stop and pump a cup full and have it. That was quite a deal. Then every Saturday afternoon, it seems so half the town would attend the Robin Hood Theater. That was located just right next to the Old Kent Bank,
right,
presently. And, of course, it was Wild West Pictures on Saturday afternoon, Hoke Gibson and Tom Mix and Buck Rogers and a few of those. And Dick Bridles would play the Bartola. It was like an organ down there. And he was a crackerjack at it. And Charlie Davis was the manager of the theater. And any kid created a disturbance down there, leave it to Charlie. He'd go right down there and get him by the nape of the neck and march him right out. They were kicked out.
But disturbances come at
all? Oh, not too often, no, because they didn't want to get kicked out, and Charlie would get you sooner or later. But that place would just be packed every Saturday afternoon. Then on Tuesdays, I would kind of talk my folks into giving me enough money so I could go down. This would be Tuesday evenings, and go to the Robin Hood, where they'd have a serial going on. It was every Tuesday, so you wouldn't see the whole picture for maybe a month before you could see all the chapters of it. But that was on a rare occasion that they'd let me go out at night to go down there and watch those serials. Right next to the theater was Ewing's popcorn stand. And of course, get a nickel bag of popcorn and take it in the theater with you. Then many times in the evening, my mother wouldn't want to cook, so she'd give me a quarter and ask me to go down to Dornbos's fish house. And you could get a quarter's worth of smoked chub, and that'd be enough for three of us for supper. Real good. My father owned the Grand Haven Bacon Company. He started it along with two partners in 1900. And that was located at 214 Washington. I think there's a shoe store in there now, if I'm not mistaken. And I used to work there during the summer after I got old enough to be able to do a few chores. And I'd wash pots and pans, swept the floor. I had to wrap bread, fried donuts, and make some minor deliveries. And then on the Saturday before the Robin Hood Theater would open, I'd sell candy. And my dad had quite a candy business there. Then I'd earn enough money so I could go across and go to the movie afterwards.
No. Bakeries were more of a general all-purpose kind of establishment in those
yes,
days.
Yes, yes. It was a pretty good-sized bakery. It he had, of course, originally they did the delivery with horse and wagons. And there was a large barn in back of the bakery. As I remembered, there were three stalls for horses and a big hayloft, and he had a wagon that they'd deliver bread and pastries during the summer months, and then they had a sleigh that they'd use during the winter months. And I frequently would go with the drivers to make the route with them, and they'd pedal to the local grocery stores, and then they'd go over the bridge to Spring Lake and Ferrisburg. But I can remember going across the bridges in the wintertime when it was storming. And, of course, we had the sleigh, but it had doors on it, so we were all inside. Oh. Kept warm that way.
Now, would the bakery sell most of its goods directly, or would it, like, ship things out to stores? Would people buy, say, if somebody wanted to buy a loaf of bread, would they buy
yes.
it directly
you
from
could
your
either
bakery,
way.
Or would your bakery sell it to a grocery store and people would buy their bread at
the outlet? We had a retail outlet. Front part of it was all retail.
Okay.
And so that they, I think he, as I remember, he had two clerks, ladies in there selling. And then, of course, he'd also sell these to stores. All the grocery stores were customers. And at one time, he was shipping bread on the train as far as South Chicago. They'd load it on the train at night and they'd pedal it that way. So we had quite a business there. Then I can remember, again, when I was quite young, I used to go with my dad when he'd deliver bread to the car ferries. So all the car ferries were coming into Grand Haven at that time. And he had all the car ferry business. And we'd go down there, and I always liked to go with them because we'd go in the kitchen, and generally the car ferry cook would give me a sandwich or some little cookie or something there, so I used to get a kick out of that. Then in the wintertime, I guess it wasn't too infrequent, where the car ferries would get stuck in the ice. And, of course, they'd run out of food, and my dad would have to deliver bread to them. And use my toboggan and pull it across the ice to the boats. Of course, I presume that ice was anywhere 3 to 10 feet thick, so it held them, but that was always kind of a scary operation. I can always remember, and I think most of the older people around Grand Haven remember on Saturdays, that was cream puff day in the bakery. And he'd make these cream puffs with real whipped cream. And when I mean they were filled. Mm-hmm. And they'd sell them for 10 cents a piece. Mm-hmm. And he used to sell them by the dozens. Mm-hmm. Real popular. Then in 1926, my dad sold the bakery. And he bought a 20-acre grape farm on the outskirts of Spring Lake. That was on Lake Avenue, just before you get to the Lloyd Bio Bridge. Okay. On the right-hand side. There was the grape farm. And, of course, in the winter months, we had to trim the grape vines. So we had four stalks, two in the lower, two uppers. And then the early spring, we'd have to tanglefoot those stalks and the wires that held the stalks up to keep the cutworms from eating the buds and the grapes. We had to tie the grapes up to the wires, the stalks up there. Of course, then during the summer months, we had to do the fertilizing, cultivating, and then we put handles on the grape baskets. We'd buy the baskets, but they had no handles on them, and so we'd have to nail those handles on them. Then in the fall, primarily in September, that was when we picked the grapes. And then my job was to nail the covers on the baskets and deliver to the Robbins Dock in Grand Haven. Use the bakery truck for that. And then they'd ship these grapes to Chicago and Milwaukee. And there was a lot of grape farms in those days throughout Spring Lake, and they'd all bring their grapes down there, and it was quite a sight, and it just smelled wonderful, all those grapes down there in that warehouse. And the boats always left at 10 o'clock at night, so we had to have our shipment down there ready by 10. And they'd load it on either the Alabama or the United States, and they'd take them over to Milwaukee, Chicago. So the first year that we lived in Spring Lake, I was going to high school in Grand Haven, so I'd ride the interurban back and forth. And then the interurbans ceased operating. I can't remember whether it was about 1927 or 1928. Then for another year or two, they ran a bus. The interurban line ran a bus. And so we'd take the bus, and that went out of business. So then it was either hitchhiking, riding a bike, or walking. And I can remember I rode the last interurban out of Grand Haven. My mother drove me over to Grand Haven. I got on the interurban and rode it back to Spring Lake. And then, of course, it went on to the, I guess you'd call it the Boneyard in Fruitport. But it was kind of a sad thing when the urbans ceased to operate, because a lot of people depended on them for transportation.
Yeah, there still weren't many cars on the road.
Not too many. There were some, but not a lot. And they weren't too dependable either. The popular dance halls at the time were, of course, the Barn. That was located on Water Street. It was owned, operated by Nat Robbins. And Victor Peter Lonis was the manager. And the Barn burned in 1940, somewhere early 40s, I think.
Now, was the Barn that draw a pretty general crowd, or was that mainly a younger crowd there?
Oh, just general. Young, older. It was a beautiful dance floor, and they'd have Frank Jones Orchestra played quite a few years. They'd have some name bands come in, too. They had a huge globe in the center of the dance floor that revolved around, and was all mirrors and different colors.
Yeah.
Oh, it was terrific. And then they had a little soda bar there that you would get sodas or ice cream, sandwiches. Then they give you setups. There was no liquor in those days, but the fellows would bring their own liquor, and we'd serve them a glass with ice for it. But that was really a very fine dance hall. Then they also, at that time, had the Highland Park Pavilion. And that was a very popular dance place also. And Jimmy Kalkowski played out there quite frequently. And he was from Muskegon. He had an orchestra up here from Muskegon. And he played there. They also had some name bands. So they were, I think the barn and the Highland Park were kind of rivals in the dance crowd.
Was dancing one of the most popular attractions in those days?
I would say that it was, yes. Yeah. And we also had the Fruitport Pavilion, which was very popular. Frank Lockage played up there, and also big name bands. And then we had Moore's Barn. It was located on Mercury Drive. We have called it the Pottawatomie Road, but now it's Mercury Drive. Mm-hmm. And
how far out in Mercury was that?
About, I'd say, halfway. I can just visualize it, but I would say about halfway from Grand Haven out to the river.
Out my way, so.
Oh, yeah. It was a huge barn. And more like barn dances and square dancing and that sort of thing. Then they also had Jack Jungles. That was in Robinson Township. And that was a real popular one. That was right on the river. Then they had the Oakland Ballroom. It was located on 7th Street, right across from the present skating rink.
Okay.
It was a building on the upstairs. Was, they had the dances. And then another popular dancing place was the Women's Club building. And that was more for the younger groups. We'd get together and go over there, and we had orchestras and a nice time. Then the DeMolays were quite active in those days. And the Masonic Temple, I don't know, you've been there up on the third floor, nice ballroom up there. And we'd have dances up there. I belonged to the DeMolays, and we used to have some great dances. And, of course, the Spring Lake Country Club was very nice, too. And I played in the high school band under direction of M.F. Richards. And just a little sidelight there, Mr. Richards was here, I think, for about 13 years. And recently he wrote an autobiography. And there was a little article about it in the Tribune. And I managed to get a hold of a copy from Harold Fisher, and I read it, and I was very impressed with it. So I got a hold of Mr. Richards' address, and I wrote him a letter, and he wrote me a very nice letter back, along with an autographed copy of his autobiography. And I thought that was real nice of him. He was 91 on the 7th of this month. But his handwriting was excellent, and everything was just fine.
Sharp.
Yes, he was still real sharp. So our first uniforms of the Grand Haven High School band were these blue and gold sweatshirts and white duck pants. Then I think it was 1928 we got our first uniforms. And they were blue pants, and we had a cape. The inside of it, the lining was gold, and the outside was blue. And then we had the caps. So we were pretty elegant then.
How many people were in the band back then?
I would say 25, 30 possibly. Then we played several concerts, summer concerts in Central Park. And of course we played for all the football games on Saturday afternoons, which were held out the Ferry Field in those days. And we go to the Holland Tulip Festival, the Benton Harbor Blossom Festival. We had contests in Kalamazoo. And of course, for our transportation, it was all volunteers. I'd ask my folks if I could use their car, and I'd take four or five fellas. And to earn the money for the gas, we'd have paper drives. And we'd earn the money for gasoline for those trips. Then we play Memorial Day parades. And of course, we'd always have to march out to the cemetery and back. Then before the big football games, especially with Holland, we'd have a snake dance. And we start out the high school and go downtown, and we go around, maybe we have a little pep band, and then big bonfire, and do a little rabble-rousing. Then I also played in the Spring Lake Band. While I was in high school, we lived in Spring Lake, and Mark Sietsma, he was from Ferrysburg, and he was the director. And he could play cornet, and he was one of the old-timers, real loud circus-type music. And there must have been, maybe 20 of us in that band. And we used to have an awful lot of fun. And every week we'd play a concert in the Spring Lake Tourist Park. A little bandstand there, and we'd fight the mosquitoes and play a concert. And we had a lot of fun. And I also played in the orchestra, which was a high school orchestra, and we called it the Blue and Gold Revelers. And I think there were about eight of us in that band, around eight of us. And we play for social hours up at school once a month after school, 4 o'clock, we'd have a social hour for an hour, and we'd play for those dances. There was also another orchestra, Bob Smith's orchestra, that would alternate with us in playing. We had a lot of fun. Then I played with Victor Peterlonis's orchestra. Victor Peterlonis worked for Nat Robbins. He was his accountant. He also managed the barn, but he was a very fine violinist. And he got up an orchestra to play around town. We played at the Elks quite a lot and Spring Lake Country Club. And it was a real nice orchestra. And then after Peterlonis bowed out, Louis Horvath took over. And again, we played those kind of places around town. Then I played with Ted Moore's orchestra. And we played at the Oakland Ballroom. You remember, it was the one that crossed the street from the skating rink.
Right.
Then we get up to the museum, and I don't know whether you want to get into any of that, but...
A couple of general things. First, I was wondering about schooling in your youth, what that was like.
Okay, I think that the new high school, if I remember right, was built in 1922. Up until that time, it was all in the, what we call the central building,
okay. That
one that burned down. And then in 22, they had the new high school, so that the four grades, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th were in the new high school. And all the other 8th grades were into the old central building. And I don't know what I could tell you about them. Of course, we had, in those days, we had a very fine basketball team. In fact, I think it was in 1932 that we got the Class A championship, State of Michigan. Under good coach Corus, and are there any other questions you could ask me about the school?
Specifically, what were expected of students in those days?
Well, one thing I will say, that we had law and order. There was no horsing around, no running in the halls. We had Mr. Olson was the superintendent, principal, and Mr. Babcock was the superintendent. They were both very, very strict. And they just would grab you by the nape of the neck, and in the office you go. If you got chewed out by either one of them, you remembered it. So I will say there was no running and no yelling or any of that carousing in the school. And that, I think, when I look back, I take my hat off to them. At the time, we didn't think too much of it.
Right.
But, yes, we did our share of skipping school and that, but it was a minimum part of it. I mentioned the band. We used to go on these trips with the band. Never had any problems at all. Mr. Richards had very good control over all the members. So we had our playground in between the two schools. Of course, after we got in the high school, we didn't have recess or anything like that. But up until then we'd have our recess in the morning and afternoon, go out and play in the grounds. Very rarely was there a fight. Once in a while, a couple of guys would square off, but didn't want too much. Mm-hmm. Can't think of anything else that would be of interest there.
Another thing I was wondering about was the Depression. How did that affect both the area in general and your life more specifically?
It was real rough. Of course, I graduated in 32, right in the heart of the Depression in Grand Haven. I think the Depression started in 29, but I don't think it really caught up to us until around the 31, 32. And it was real tough. You couldn't get jobs. Of course, maybe I was one of the fortunate ones. My dad had the bakery, and we also had the farm, which I could work on and earn a little money. But I mentioned the pulp boats and the cement boats. We moved to Grand Haven in 1933, and that's when I started to work on the pulp boats and the cement boats. And I can remember going around these different factories, big long lines of fellows waiting to get jobs. They give you an application, but you never heard from them. I came up to Muskegon, I can remember, and went to practically every shop up here, and you just couldn't buy a job in those days. And of course, they give preference to those fellows, that men who had families, children, which is understandable. And that's when I decided to go into the Army. So in 1933, I had to pull quite a few strings to get into the Army. I had letters from Mr. Babcock, Mr. Olson, Mr. Richards, and the postmaster, Mr. Olson, who was a captain of the National Guard. And he knew the family well, so he gave me a letter. Ted Bolton, the bank, I can remember he was bank president. He gave me a letter of recommendation. And what I was trying to do was get into the Army band.
Ah, I see.
And so the third time, he said, all right, I'll put you in G Company first. And then maybe that will attach you to the band, but we don't have an opening in the band as such. So I said anything. So I was very happy to get there. And I remember my pay was $17.35 a month, private's pay. And of course, out of that, I had to buy my toilet articles, take care of my laundry bills. Food and all that other was furnished. All the clothing was furnished. So on that $17.35 a month, I bought a car. An old Model A was going to beat up. I think I paid $155 for it or something. But anyway, it was so I could get home once in a while. And I was stationed in Detroit, Fort Wayne, Detroit. And So I was in G Company, but every morning then I would go over to the band and rehearse with the band. And eventually there was an opening, and I got in the band. And then they had another opening as company clerk of the band, and I was selected for that job. And that did a lot to further my education. I went to several other clerk school there, typing, bookkeeping, and so forth. And that was a great experience for me, being in the Army. I enjoyed it immensely, and especially when I look back, we had excellent food. It was just terrific. And, of course, we'd have our weekends off, other than once in a while we'd have to play a concert. And I also played in their dance orchestra, the band's dance orchestra. And we had to play for dances for the officers, also for enlisted men. Then I played another little pickup group, a bunch of us that was outside of the Army. And we'd go around some of these 3-2 beer gardens. That time they had 3-2 beer gardens. Mm-hmm. And all we'd do was put a hat out there, and they'd drop donations in there, and we'd play. So maybe we'd get $1 a piece a night or something like that. And then, of course, in the summertime, we'd move to Camp Custer in Battle Creek. And we'd have our summer training there. And I remember this one year, I think it was the last year I was in the Army. I was in it for 3 years. We hiked, marched from Detroit to Camp Custer.
How long did that take?
120 miles. And I think we did it, if I remember right, in about 10 days. We'd try to march around 15 to 20 miles a day. But my feet were full of blisters. Oh, it was terrible. Because we weren't in condition. We laid around all winter, you know, and here was early spring. We were marching like that. But I could get home a little more often when we were at Camp Custer. They didn't have to go so far. So I'd try to get home a couple times a month on weekends. I'd get a good weekend pass. But I'll truthfully say I enjoyed my service in the Army at that time. It was real fun.
So when you got back here, what did you do?
I got married the day after I was discharged. came to Detroit, and we got married in Detroit. And we came back, and my first job was at Story & Clark Piano Company. I had a friend that found another job, and he was leaving Story & Clark, so he tipped me off, and he said, get down there. So I think it was the third day I was home after being discharged. I went down there, and I saw Mr. Claypeck, and he gave me a job. I was fine regulating. And I worked with Ray Harris. Ray was very helpful in getting me started. And I worked in several departments. I leaded keys for a while, and I installed the actions. And I worked down in the mill room. And I was scared to death down there, those machines. In those days, they didn't have too many guards. And those planers are going around, you know, I could just look around at all my fellow workers, and all of them had a finger or two off, you know, and I could just visualize myself. So I started to look around for something else, and I found a job up at Lakey Foundry in the employment office. And I had a friend working in there, and he put in a good word for me. So I worked a second shift up there, and my job was, I was timekeeper for the pattern shop. I took care of first aid, and I did some posting Social Security records. And then, I worked a second shift. A lot of times somebody wouldn't show up for work. Then I'd have to go out and get some replacement. Uh-huh. And we had a list of replacements. We had a company car, but mostly blacks. But at midnight, many times, I'd go right in the worst black areas in here in Muskegon and in the Heights and get recruit people. Never was fearful of no problems at all. They treated you with a lot of respect. I never had any trouble. And I, from Lakey's, I I worked, I got laid off up there in 38, and that was just the tail end of the Depression before the war, and things were still kind of slow. So I got a job over in Grand Haven to would-be producers. They made radio cabinets, and my job was, along with several others, was to roll the grain. When you look at that here, this table, it's got nice grain in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we would put that grain on. We'd just get some old fine white pine, no grain at all, and we had a roller. We'd roll it on this plate with ink, pick up that grain off this plate,
uh-huh.
and then we'd roll it on here, and you just get a perfect grain, and they'd put the varnish and everything on top of it. So, in other words, we were fooling the public, letting them think they got a nice piece of grain wood. It was all artificial. Then during that time, I kind of worked off and on. They weren't too busy. Then I, Mr. Richard asked me if I would help him with a band up at high school. So I was assistant director up there that 1 year off and on. Not steady, but I helped drill them for the football games and so forth. Then I got a job at Wachter Motor Sales in Spring Lake. Joe Wachter, he had worked for Tillman Auto Company in Grand Haven, and then he decided to go in business for himself, and he got bought out this Spears Motor Car Company in Spring Lake, and it was all Fords. So I worked there for 5 years with Joe. I took care of the books, parts, and I also greased cars and took care of the pumps. I had gas pumps, took care of them. And, of course, this is where my Army training helped a lot, taking care of the books and that.
Mm-hmm.
So then the war came along, and I tried to re-enlist. And I guess, Pearl Harbor's December 7th, and I think January 2nd, I went up to Grand Rapids to the recruit office up there. And I took my discharge and everything. I was discharged as a corporal. And I said, I'd like to re-enlist in grade. I'd like my old outfit. Well, he says, I can't do anything for you here. He said, I suggest, he said, the only thing I can do is just enlist you as a buck private. And I said, gee, I don't want to go through all that recruit training again. No, he said, I don't blame you, but he said, I can't do anything for you. He said, I'd suggest you go home and wait for the draft board to catch up with you. So until this day, I'm still waiting. But I did, I left Wachter Motor Sales then, and I went and worked at Ramsey Corporation in Fruitport. They were a war plant. They made piston rings for the B-24 bombers. And I was a personnel manager up there. I worked there for 9 years, 9.5 years. Then I had an opportunity to go with Keller Tool Company in Grand Haven as assistant personnel manager. And of course that was a lot better because we lived in Grand Haven, and this way I could work in the town where I lived. So I got over there and I worked there for 27 years. I finally became manager of employee relations when I retired. Well, that's pretty much my work history.
Were you involved with the pharmacy?
No. That was strictly Cliff's.
Strictly his.
Yeah. After he was discharged from the service, he went to Ferris and became a pharmacist. And he worked for Wheeler's for a while. And he had this opportunity to buy out Carl Hetzel, which he did. And, so he was strictly on his own down there. So then I retired from Gardner Denver in 1977. And they called me back twice since I retired for special projects, you know. And Cooper merged with them, Cooper Tool, Air Tool. And of course they moved out, and they'd call me back 6 months before they moved out. And so I was the last one employed there in Grand Haven. Henry Klukas and myself, Henry was in charge of maintenance, and I had everything else. So Henry and I were the ones that locked the door, finally.
Okay. Now, how did you get involved with starting up the Historical Society and the museum?
Well, this goes back, and I can't, I'm sorry to say, remember the year, but Esther Dean Nylon was a school teacher, and she was quite involved with history. She liked it, of Grand Haven. And she had sort of a historical society of her school kids. Anyway, she got the idea to form a historical society of Grand Haven. And she knew the family from way back. Anyway, she asked if we'd join, and along with maybe a couple dozen other people in Grand Haven. So we had a meeting down in the basement of the Presbyterian Church. We organized down there. So both my wife and I are charter members. And we started this society. And I was the third president. See, Dave Seibold was first president. George Crispin was the second. And I was the third. Anna was the fourth. I was president of 2 terms. And during that time, every once in a while at our meetings, somebody would say, we ought to have a museum. So we all agreed, but nothing was ever done. Well, finally we started accumulating a few things. And Ray Swanson was a secretary of our society. And he also was the secretary of the Masonic Lodge at that time. And he said, I'm going to talk to their board of directors and see if we can't use some of their rooms to store these things that we're accumulating. And because they had this Oaks's building, and there were a lot of rooms up there they weren't using. So they agreed that let us do that. So we started to bring things in. Well, then Dr. Mary got into the picture. And stuff started to come. It's like you wouldn't believe.
It hasn't stopped.
No,
this day,
I know what you mean. So anyway, we'd haul this stuff upstairs. It was all upstairs, you know. And we'd try to clean it up the best we could, you know. There was, I can still remember, there was an old kerosene heater, and that was my project. It was just full of rust, and we had steel wool, and it was steel wool and the rust off of it. Anyway, we had that opened a couple of times for the public to walk through, but it was a mess up there. Everything was piled up on top of each other. It was very unimpressive. Well, then I can remember we had a meeting in the basement of the city hall, and this question came up again. Why don't we have a museum? So I finally stood up. I said, I think I'm getting a little sick and tired of hearing this come up all the time. I'm going to put a motion on the floor that we organize a committee and establish a museum. Well, this thought came up with this Grand Trunk Depot all the time. It came into the picture. So I said, we'll form this committee and we'll investigate the possibility of getting that Grand Trunk Depot, converting it into a museum. So everybody started nodding. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So we put it to a vote, and of course it went through unanimous. And Esther Dean got up and she said, I nominate John Paff as general chairman. And I couldn't say anything, yes or no. I felt that I had got up, put the motion on the floor, so I had to carry through. So I said, okay. So anyway, they made me general chairman. So with the job of raising the money, securing the depot, bring it into a museum. So I got busy and appointed different ones on the committee, different committees. Esther Dean, bless her heart, she took on raising the money. And she did a beautiful job of it. Of course, that's when we put out life memberships and all that. Mm-hmm. She went to these different companies around town. We wrote letters and everything, and foundations, and money started to come in. Well, we had a little problem with the city because they wanted to bulldoze that museum down for a parking lot for the fountain. They had all parking there. So then the minute we said we want to make it into a museum, then Marge Boone, I hate to mention names, but anyway, it was Marge at this one meeting that we held. She wanted to make it into a coffee house for the kids. She said, I think the kids need a coffee house in town. Well, of course, we all got up in our ear, and her brother Cliff was on the council at the time. So, of course, he was pulling for the museum. Anyway, we had to do a lot of politicking, and we finally got the city. I know I met with John Walhout several times, and the city manager, said, well, you know, they want to charge us pretty good rent for it. And I said, no, I think it's a community project. $1 a year for rent is sufficient. Mm-hmm. Anyway, make a long story short, we finally all compromised on $1 a year, and we could have the Grand Trunk. But I'm getting a little ahead of my story. After we had this meeting where they made me chairman, this was in the spring of the year. It was cold. Or fall of year. Yeah, before Christmas, I guess. Anyway, it was cold. Anyway, we said, let's go down and see what we got down here. Mm-hmm. So we got over the key and we went in there. You never saw such a mess in all your life. The dust had accumulated that thick all over everything. Cool. There was all junk piled in there. You wouldn't believe it. Decorations for the city, piled stuff in there. It was almost a hopeless task. But anyway, we did. We all finally rolled up our sleeves. We got down there and got volunteers. My wife, she was a big, big help in that. She wrote letters and she called up people by the dozens, you know, different organizations like the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts to come down and help clean it all up. We got everything cleared out of there, all down to the dump, you know, good news. Then we got the paintbrushes. Remember Frank Sanders? Well, you remember him, a teacher up at high school? Steve Mead. I hate to name names because I'm missing so many of them, because there were just dozens of them. They all rolled up their sleeves and went down there, and we painted that thing from one end to the other. And Chet Anderson, of course, got involved, and he was the handyman with the saw and the hammer. And we got the thing all cleared out. Then we had to bring the stuff in, set it up. And I thought we did a pretty nice job. And I, of course, in the meantime, we had been soliciting new members. And I always remember that Perry DeVille, he was a member of the National Guard. He called me up one day at work and he said, you know, can the National Guard help you out in any way down there? And I said, boy, you sure can. We got to move everything from our rooms in the Masonic Temple building down there. And what I mean, we had some big stuff up there. We sideboards, everything up there. Nice. So they did. They bought their trucks, and those guys moved all that stuff down there in the museum. Of course, then we had our committees and set up the various rooms, got the thing going. I stay on as director, general, and everyone for 2 years. And I devoted hundreds and hundreds of hours, so did they have. And of course, I had girls out the office too, and they did a lot of government work for me out there. Mm-hmm. and typing and that. Of course, we wrote, had to write so many letters thanking people and requesting this and requesting that. I got them out there to design this little brochure we used to pass out. I don't know whether they still use that or not.
They have a brochure. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Same one.
I suppose they've changed it over the years, but anyway, got that. And I can remember Paul Helmer was the secretary of the Chamber of Commerce. And we were a couple days before opening date. And he came over and he took one look and he just was just so elated. He couldn't get over it, what we had done in this museum. And then when he saw our brochures, he said, "I want 10,000 of them. I said, "Wait a minute, Paul." I said, "We don't have that kind of money." He said, "I'll pay for them. I'll pay for them. Just get me them." He said, "I'm going to send them to every town in Michigan." And he did. He sent them, mailed them all out, you know. And which was good advertising.
Yeah.
And then we had open house for the everybody, townspeople. And it was in the afternoon, a Sunday afternoon. We had a terrific turnout. And then on, it's just been up, up, up. And of course, Maury Wilson was very helpful mm-hmm. through those periods too. And then when I left, well, he took over. And so they say I can't begin to name people because there were so many that got involved to help. It's just terrific. But it's very gratifying. When I look at it today, what it is and what they're doing. Yes, compared to what I saw that first night we went into that Grand Trunk Depot.
And hopefully what we can keep doing.
Yes. Well, I think that it's got a good start now. I'm sorry that millage didn't pass.
Yeah, but hurt.
It hurt, but we still got quite a lot of money there. When I think that we raised, while I was in there, we raised $20,000. And when I left, there was still 5,000 of the 20 in the treasury. So we did what we did to get the thing started on 15,000.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. But I'm real proud of it. I think we started the waterfront on its way. I don't think the waterfront would be what it is today if it wasn't for that museum.
I agree.
Yeah.